So this evening I'm going to talk about metta, loving kindness, the ninth of the 10 paramis. And at this point in the practice, first of all, it's still a practice. Even metta is always a practice, but it's also, in some sense, the fruits of the practice. If we've done all the other things we've done along the way, we're now we're starting to sort of have something happen, bear fruit. And one of the things that bears fruit is our own heart opens. And that's really a lot of what I want to talk about. But so as I said, this is metta. Metta often usually is translated as loving kindness. So it isn't love, it's not it's like kindness, but in from a loving perspective. It's also sometimes you see it translated as goodwill, which is added having goodwill towards all beings, as opposed to ill will, the opposite, right? And on the face of it, it's like it seems pretty simple. It's like, oh, of course, I have goodwill towards other people. We all like to think we're good people. It's like natural that we don't have a problem in this area. But the truth is, we all do, to a certain extent, some more than others, of course. And it's because we all have these reactive mental patterns that cause us to respond to certain people or certain situations, certain groups of people, with thoughts and even words and actions that express ill will and that cause suffering to arise both for ourselves and for others. So the Buddha was very aware of this, of course, and metta was what he taught, essentially, to help deal with this. It would be nice, of course, if we could just sort of make a firm resolution, you know? I'm not going to think or speak or act in unkind ways. That would be nice. But we all know that this isn't enough. It's like we can form that intention very clearly, but it's easy to slip back into our old reactive patterns. So loving kindness is, in some sense, something we have to cultivate, something we have to practice. But it's sort of elusive, isn't it? How can we practice something this elusive? And the Buddha laid out very precise instructions in the Metta Sutta, which is his teachings on loving kindness. I want to mention here that the story behind there's an interesting story behind this. Basically, the Buddha and his Sangha, they would wander, except in the rainy season, they'd all get together, but otherwise they were sort of like wandering monks. So he was wandering with a small group of students, and they used to go to these remote sort of jungle thickets and forests, places that weren't a lot of other people, so they wouldn't be that disturbed, but close enough to a village or something where they could go for alms rounds. So they're in this place, and the Buddha says, "All right, you guys, why don't you go into the forest and sit for the day and come back this evening? Go find a root of a tree to sit at," right? And they came back at the end of the day, the bhikkhus, and they were all like really upset. And the Buddha said, "Well, what's going on? How come you guys are so upset? I thought you were going to be meditating all that." And they said, "Oh, this forest is horrible. It's full of these evil tree spirits, and they're trying to scare us, and they're really scary. Whether you believe in tree spirits or just believe that it was a really creepy forest, whatever, doesn't make any difference." And so the Buddha said, "Oh, okay. Well, we can solve that." And he taught the Metta Sutta. He taught this practice of loving kindness, which is this. And as he describes in the sutta, it has to be loving kindness for all beings. So he's telling them basically, well, have thoughts of loving kindness towards these tree spirits who are so disturbing. And they go out into the forest the next day and they come back and things are okay. In fact, not only do the tree spirits not bothering them anymore, now the tree spirits are bothering other people and might come and disturb them and scaring them away, so they have a nice quiet place to practice. But the idea here is metta, the original intent of metta was to combat fear. That was the original intent, just to help us work with our fear of things around us. And remember that fear, often the response to when we're really afraid is we act in places of ill will, because we blame someone. There, you're making me afraid, and it's all your fault. And so we fall into blame and ill will very quickly when fear arises. So I just want to quote a few little pieces of the Sutta. And the first of these is where the Buddha's talking about how intensely should you practice metta when you're if you're going to practice metta, but what's the intensity that you should practice? And I'm actually going to chant this little bit of Sutta, because that's traditionally how this is taught, as you chant it. So, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. In other words, think about how what the love of a mother for her only child, how strong that energy would be. So it's like it's when you practice metta, you have to it has to be as strong as you can imagine. It's like full open-hearted for others. And then in another section of the sutta, he says, well, how diligently should we practice, or when should you practice? And if these following lines are there: whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. So, first of all, the first line, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down. Well, when are we not doing one of those four things, right? This is a classic Buddha. You see this in other suttas as well. But it's basically the Buddha saying all the time. There's no half measure. This is an all the time practice. Free from drowsiness, which means when you do it, you have to do it diligently. You have to be really sort of precise about it. And one should sustain this recollection. This is the idea that we have to keep remembering, that this isn't something that happens automatically. We actually have to remember to have thoughts of loving kindness towards all beings. So we have to practice all the time, and we have to practice alertly. The practice itself, at least as I've learned it, and first of all, I'll say I've heard and read about many other ways to practice metta than what I'm about to suggest. This is one of those things where a lot of creativity has been occurred. So this is what I'm teaching you is something that comes out of the forest monk tradition of Burma, which is where my teachers studied before they came back to North America and taught me and other people. And basically, the idea is you have these four phrases that you say over and over and over again. So it isn't like mindfulness where you sit and just pay attention to what's arising. Instead, you consciously are repeating and forming this energy of loving kindness. And that, so the four phrases are: may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. So think about this. If you always felt safe, happy, healthy, or as healthy as you can be, And to live with ease means to have no worries about material things, that everything is okay. Think if that was your the environment that you functioned in. How easy it would be, how easy your life would be, number one, and how easy it'd be to have a heart full of loving kindness for others, because you got no hassles here. There's nothing that's a problem. Everything is okay. It isn't like, and there isn't like, may you be rich and wealthy and be a millionaire. That isn't what the Buddha was ever talking about. It was just like then you have this sort of grounded space where everything is okay, so you can just focus on your practice. And then when we're actually practicing, you literally just repeat these four phrases, or phrases similar to this, or similar to this in meaning. So I want to make that clear too. I've seen lots of different versions of these phrases. In fact, I've used different versions myself. So people find versions of these phrases that suit them. For instance, may you be safe. For a while, I was working with the phrase, may you be safe from inner and outer harm. This sort of make it a little more precise, and because that's what I was at that point. May you be happy. I had a teacher who said, no, I can't say that. That's asking too much. I just want, so she would say, may I be content? Which is like, everything's okay, but I'm not wishing for more than I can expect. So I'm just wishing I can be content. And so on. So you can sort of see. But the idea is to have this set of phrases, and then you repeat them over and over. So you sit, and then you just start repeating the phrases, and you have not only you don't just repeat the phrases, you sort of tune into what those phrases mean for you, and for if you're repeating these phrases with someone else in mind, what this means for them, which might be different than what is for you. I mean, what being safe means for me, Mr. 6 foot 4, 235-pound guy, is very different than something that might mean something different for someone who is smaller or hasn't got that sort of weight behind their actions or whatever, or had a difficult life. So we all have different senses of what these words mean. So it's important that you have a clear idea of what they mean for you. But eventually, essentially, all we're doing is, as I said, we fall into ill will because we have these reactive patterns where we sort of start telling ourselves old stories and those sorts of things. And what the intent of metta is let's just fill our minds with thoughts of loving kindness. Let's just keep repeating these phrases, and that fills my mind with that. And if I fill my mind with thoughts of loving kindness, there's no room for thoughts of ill will. It's really that, it sounds sort of simple, but it is really that simple. It's like if I can just keep my mind full of thoughts of loving kindness, of goodwill, there's no room for thoughts of ill will. I'm just sort of rewiring my normal patterns into a different set of patterns. I'm like rewiring my mind by consciously over and over and over again wishing thoughts of loving kindness. The other thing is, this practice has to be for all beings. We can't have thoughts of loving kindness just for people we like anyway, just for people we know. It has to be literally. In other sections of the sutta, the Buddha talks about how important it is to have thoughts of loving kindness for all beings without exception. Think what that would be like to actually every being that you encountered, every living being that you encountered in any way, you had thoughts of loving kindness towards them. To me, that's a one interesting definition of what it would like to be enlightened. If I could operate in that way all the time, without exception. It's just an interesting thought, and that's where we might want to go or think about it. So when we do this practice, the first thing we have to think about, and I have a huge number of a large pile of books here today, so I want to talk about this from a number of different points of view and different perspectives from different teachers. So the first thing we have to understand is that when we practice metta, you know, you might have different beings in mind or different classes of or groups of beings. But you always, always, without exception, practice metta for self first. If you can't have thoughts of loving kindness towards yourself, it's going to be very difficult to have thoughts of loving kindness towards anybody else. So, and this sort of goes against some sort of cultural things we have, like, oh, I'm supposed to be taking care of everybody else, right? No. Or it sounds selfish or greedy or something. But no, if you can't take, if you don't take care of yourself, how can you possibly take care of anyone else with an open heart? So this is what Sharon Salzberg has to say. This is from her book, Loving Kindness. The practice of metta, uncovering the force of love that can uproot fear, anger, and guilt, begins with befriending ourselves. The foundation of metta practice is to know how to be our own friend. According to the Buddha, you can search throughout the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself, and that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserves your love and affection. This is actually from a sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. How few of us embrace ourselves in this way? With metta practice, we uncover the possibility of truly respecting ourselves. We discover, as Walt Whitman put it, I am larger and better than I thought. I did not think I held so much goodness. So this idea of having thoughts of loving kindness towards the self is really important. In fact, I have two, I want to read from two other books about this topic just to make sure I'm precise enough. This first is, this is a book called Living Kindness, quite a beautiful little book, by someone named Kevin Griffin, who I actually met. He's quite a wonderful person, actually. And he's talking about the same thing. He has a different perspective, perhaps. When it comes to loving others, it makes sense that if our feelings towards ourselves are unkind, any effort to be kind to others will be adulterated. These efforts will always be colored by some form of neediness. Either we will be trying to get validation from others or trying to compensate for our lack of self-worth by being extra good. These external efforts will never succeed as long as our inner world feels barren. And it's that very barren feeling that makes us think we don't deserve love. We look inside and see anxiety and sadness, worry and stress, irritation and judgment. Then we equate feeling bad with being bad. In this formulation, if we are bad, then we clearly don't deserve love. This is like brilliant. Yeah. The key sentence here is, then we equate feeling bad with being bad. We feel bad, you know, I'm grumpy, I'm sad, I'm lonely, and whatever it is. And then we think there's something wrong with us to be feeling that. And this is simply not true at all. And we have to take that in and accept it. And we have to have thoughts of loving kindness towards ourselves. He goes on. Instead of self-judgment, metta encourages us to care for ourselves simply because we are suffering. Acknowledging that we suffer. that we're not perfect, that we aren't always full of joy. Instead of self-judgment, metta encourages us to care for ourselves simply because we are suffering, to be kind to the sadness and worry, to be gentle with the judgment and irritation. We can actually give love to those very feelings. Rather than fighting with our inner life, we open to it with acceptance and compassion. Accepting that we all have this as part of who we are. That we aren't all full of joy and light all the time. And yet another source. This is Ajahn Sasidhya's book, Parami, which I've been reading from a lot during this thing. And he's talking very sort of sweetly, actually. Says, who isn't touched by acts of kindness? Who isn't moved by the intention to pervade the all-encompassing world, that's taken from the Sutta, to others as to themselves, with a mind imbued with a kindness? Or by the phrase, even as a mother protects her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. So he's quoting it again from the Sutta. The ideal of kindness and goodwill is the Buddhist tradition, is expressed in these traditional phrases, and it is shared by all spiritual paths. Kindness is immediately and obviously a big part of what spirituality and true humanity is all about. We can all experience goodwill towards some being at some time. However, we all lose touch with that bright way of relating, especially to ourselves. So it's valuable to bring to mind that each of us has at some time been on the receiving end of freely given goodwill. It's one of the recollections or 5-minute meditations that is useful to undertake throughout the day. So he's pointing out that he has this practice of actually reminding himself over and over again during the day that, oh, look, there's another act of goodwill I just experienced. And because often we don't take that in because we're all so tense and looking for what's wrong. And this is different. So far, I've never found a day when someone didn't offer a kind word, ask if I needed something, or even talked about our conflict in a gentle and non-hurtful way. With all of this, I acknowledge they didn't have to do that. So when you're feeling bitter, anxious, or lonely, remember this. At some time, you have been seen with a loving and sympathetic eye. Stay with that impression. Breathe in and out and extend it. Also recall, no matter how mean you may think you are, you experience goodwill towards something. We all do. They say that even Hitler loved his dog. However, it's clearly the case that for most beings, this channel of goodwill gets blocked from time to time by a flood of ill will. Therefore, we need a means to carry the heart across the floods that submerge our fellow feelings. And when we make the resolution of kindness, not just towards kittens on a nice day, but even towards cockroaches on a bad day, when we include dictators and brutal maniacs, as well as all aspects of ourselves, then we're making metta into a perfection, a vast and transfiguring way of life. The result of fulfillment of the parami is a mind that is grounded in wisdom and compassion, and which easily opens to the peace of nibbana. So he's saying quite clearly that this idea of having this heart filled with loving kindness is a way to be open to what comes afterwards. And that's an important thing to remember. So the next question is, well, how do we, other than like this formal practice I talked about earlier, you know, saying the phrases and repeating the phrases, how do we practice loving kindness in our sort of day-to-day lives? Kevin Griffin in his book has an interesting section on this that I want to share. And then look at a few other pieces of information too. So this is it's talking about from the Majjhima Nikaya, the shorter discourse on Gosinga, which I'll read some parts of later. When Ananda heard, what Ananda heard is that the Buddha went to visit three monks who he would say were on retreat, that is, practicing silent meditation together for an extended period. The Buddha found them in a protected forest where he quizzed them on how they were getting along and how their practice was progressing. The senior of these monks, Aruda, was another cousin of the Buddha's, and he was the one who answered the Buddha's questions. The first thing the Buddha asks is if they are getting enough alms food. Since the monks weren't allowed to grow their own food or keep it overnight, they were completely dependent upon lay people to feed them. This meant that even when on retreat in a forest, they had to be living near enough to a village of some sort that they could walk there in the morning, get food, and come back without using up too much time, since their main activity was meditating. Why would the Pali Canon record this little detail, one that has no direct relevance to the teachings? I believe it's to show that the Buddha was concerned about his followers' welfare on every level, the physical as well as the spiritual. If love is caring, then this question reveals the love and compassion he had for his monks. First, he wanted to know if they were getting fed. Other questions can follow. When the Aruda says they're having no trouble getting alms food, the Buddha asks that the three monks are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And I actually want to read Aruda's response from the sutta, because it's very revealing, I think. So this is from the Majjhima Nikaya. This is just one short verse of this longer sutta. This is how Aruda said, "Venerable Sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a gain for me. It is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, Venerable Sir, but one in mind. That is how, Venerable Sir, we are living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." And there's two parts of this that I think are really important, or three actually. One is he's talking about, he said everything he says, acts of loving kindness both openly and privately. In other words, he's not making a big deal out of it. Often he's acting from a place of loving kindness and not expecting any attention. He's not even expecting anyone to even know. But it's important that he do that, that he act from that place, that he acts and speaks and thinks from a place of loving kindness. So everything is both openly and privately. And then there's this section where he talks about doing what others wish to do and setting aside what he wishes to do. Little note of caution here. We have to be careful that we don't end up becoming someone else's doormat. Like, you have to sort of take care of yourself. You still have to have thoughts of loving kindness towards yourself here. So you don't think this instruction says, well, just let people do whatever they want to do. You have to sort of have boundaries, wise boundaries. But then they say, and I love this expression, they are viewing each other with kindly eyes. What a great expression, huh? That's how we want to look upon each other, with kindly eyes. It just strikes me that that phrase as being wonderful. Anyhow. And oh yeah, I want to read one other thing. This is from Sylvia Boorstein's book, Happiness is an Inside Job. I've practiced with Sylvia several times. She has got to be the sweetest person you ever met. Talk about someone full of loving kindness. She was just like, anyhow. And she's talking about how doing this practice comes from a place of equanimity. So far, we've seen how establishing equanimity in the mind creates the conditions for the arising of the profound wisdom that in turn promotes kindness as the natural empathetic response. So it's through this calm mind, focused mind, that kindness naturally arises. The converse is also true. The expression of kindness establishes equanimity that in turn sustains wisdom, which is always consoling. So it's this balance. You see this in other places too, this balance of loving kindness and equanimity, or loving kindness and wisdom. And we have to, it's sometimes called the two wings of Dhamma. And we have to have both wings to be able to fly. We can't just be all wisdom and fierce mind. It has to be an open heart as well. And that's what she's pointing to here. That in our, both in our practice and in our life, that is essential. So here's another thought. This is the problem a lot of people find with loving kindness. Is that we're sort of being asked to add one, here's another thing you got to pay attention to. Here's another thing you have to practice. Here's another thing you have to add on to this list of other things, right? And it's like, give me a break, essentially. And it's also, like, it's a big ask, right? It's a big thing to sort of imagine adding this, being always 24/7, open and full of loving kindness. But there's a section in the sutta where the Buddha says this. Basically, he's gone through and expressed how to practice, as I described, using those four phrases essentially, and emphasizing how important it is that it be for all beings. But then he says this really interesting thing: let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. He's not talking about having goodwill. He's talking about not having ill will. It's like the flip of the coin in some sense. And sometimes it's easier to remove something, our habits of ill will, than to add in something, a habit of goodwill. It's just a different way of thinking about it. Kevin Griffin talks about this quite nicely. He says, he's talking with another sutta. He says, the theme of the sutta is the challenge of maintaining non-ill will in the face of attacks, verbal or physical. Here we see that one of the rhetorical teaching strategies of the Buddha, he seems to understand that a positive declaration of love, to love everyone, can trigger grasping. That is like, I'm going to be perfect. It turns into that grasping energy, right? He seems to understand that it can trigger grasping. So instead points us towards letting go of the obstructions to love. In this way, his rhetoric mirrors the teachings themselves. Letting go is the path to freedom. So it tells us to let of what to let go. If instead we had to set up some ideal to strive for, it would just give people something else to chase after. And again, the implication is that our natural state, when rid of these negative qualities, is a positive one. That when hatred is removed, love is naturally revealed. When greed subsides, generosity is spontaneous. This is an essential Buddhist concept, that our fundamental human nature is loving and wise. The work of Buddhist practice is to abandon the things that obscure those qualities in us. It's a nice way to think about it. It's like, oh, this is about getting not so much having those thoughts of ill will, but just getting rid of that stuff, because then my natural ability to be full of love and loving kindness and goodwill and have the mind focused just naturally will occur. It's a different angle, and it's good sometimes to think from different angles, I think. And once again, Sharon Salzberg, she's talking about this practice from an interesting, once another interesting point of view. In practicing metta, what we do not have to make a certain feeling happen. This is another issue with metta. It's like somehow we think if I'm practicing metta, I should be sort of full of this gushy, sweet, loving feeling, right? In fact, during the practice, we see that we feel differently at different times. Any momentary emotional tone is far less relevant than the considerable power of intention we harness as we say these phrases. As we repeat, may I be happy, may all beings be happy, we are planting seeds by forming this powerful intention in the mind. The seed will bear fruit in its own time. Here she's talking very directly about the second step on the Eightfold Path, wholesome intention. It's the intention to have thoughts of loving kindness. That's what's important. That's what's important. Not that you actually experience anything wonderful. It's that you have keep forming the intention. And by repeating the phrases and being aware of what they mean, you are doing just that. You're forming the intention. She goes on, when I was practicing metta intensively in Burma, at times when I repeated the phrases, I would picture myself in a wide open field planting seeds. Doing metta, we plant the seeds of love, knowing that nature will take its course and time those seeds will bear fruit. Some seeds will come to fruition quickly, some slowly, but our work is simply to plant the seeds. Every time we form the intention in the mind, for our own happiness or the happiness of others, we are doing our work. We are channeling the powerful energies of our own minds. So, this whole idea of just filling the mind with wholesome thoughts, I want to repeat that. That's what because we've set the intention and then we're just repeating the phrases or we're doing whatever we're doing. Excuse me. We're just setting the mind in a different space than our normal reactive patterns. In fact, and this is something I like to suggest in terms of practice in general, especially when you're having a difficult time emotionally, you're caught up in one of those churning stories. All those churning stories have a hero and a bad guy, or a hero and a victim, or some such combination of things. And it's just all in our mind, of course, right? We're telling ourselves a story about how this horrible person did this horrible thing, and aren't they horrible, and blah, 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 blah. And we're just re-experiencing the unwholesome emotions of that story. And it's quite interesting and skillful, right in the midst of that practice of mindfulness, to just stop and go, Once you're aware, once you've actually mindful that I'm caught in this story, and that's the energy of the story is about against this person. Hold that person in your heart mind, and offer them metta instead. Like you're really literally choosing to shift the story, to change the story from one of anger and ill will to one of loving kindness. Just shifting the story itself. This is something that the Buddha actually recommends in a famous sutta. I won't read that whole sutta tonight, but it's one of the skillful things we can do. So, and the interesting thing here is what I'm saying is something that maybe doesn't get said enough is that, we often say this practice, the mindfulness practice, is all about, just sitting and whatever's happening, just take it in. And that's great. But at a certain point, if I've taken in that same old story too many times and I've looked at it skillfully and I can see the unwholesomeness of it, at a certain point, it's much more skillful to go, nah, don't need that anymore. Let's have thoughts of loving kindness towards that person instead. Let's shift the story. Let's steer my mind a little bit. This is tricky. This is where skillful practice has to really arise, where we have to decide whether I'm actually not just being aversive. I'm not just pushing this stuff away because I don't want to think about it. I've actually looked at it and felt it and dropped into my body and experienced the unpleasantness of it more than once. Joseph Goldstein says at least five times, as a matter of fact, then it's sometimes quite skillful to go, okay, enough already. Now let's see if I can change that. It's like you're changing the dial on your TV not that anybody actually does that anymore. You're hitting the right button on your remote, I suppose, to change to a different channel. Let's just go to a different channel. Let's just have thoughts of loving kindness instead for that person. And this can be a really interesting way to just shift the mind. And what'll happen sometimes is that whole aversive ranting story just disappears because you've just filled your mind with. If your mind's full of thoughts of loving kindness, that story can't be there too. It's no room. Only one thing at a time. Our mind's a sequential processor. So we have, if we just shift the story, sometimes this is all we need to do. It's another piece of sutta here. This is another place. And in this particular sutta, the Buddha is describing the progressive steps that someone goes through as they go from originally being a novice bhikkhu, the beginner in the practice, to how he proceeds through these various stages to a place of enlightenment. And he's describing what are called the Brahma Viharas, these four wholesome mind states that arise. And this is what he says about metta. He abides pervading one quarter with the mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the second. Likewise, the third, likewise, the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere. So he's essentially being a poetic description of everyone gets included, above, below, all sides, everyone, without exception. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, don't forget yourself. He abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. Think about what those three qualifiers he has there. Abundant means that there's lots. There's as much as you could possibly want. When something's abundant, you never run out. You always have a lot. So this your heart, you want your heart mind has to be abundant with love and kindness. It's always more there. You never run out of being able to spread it around. Exalted. So not only is it abundant, but exalted is like it's uplifting. To be exalted is to be uplifted and immeasurable. In other words, you can't imagine how large that field of loving kindness is if it encompasses all beings. It's immeasurable. In fact, in certain other traditions, what I call the Brahma Viharas, the Four Noble Mind States, are called the Four Immeasurables for this exact reason, for coming straight out of the sutta. And I just like that the images here, that it's abundant, exalted, and immeasurable. Like it's just, I can't imagine what that would be like to have a heart full of loving kindness. As he said, a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without his hostility and without ill will. Just making sure we remember that too, that there's no exceptions here. I want to give Ajahn Sisitu one more chance here to say something. And here this is at this is his whole section on metta, and this is sort of his summing up, which I thought was quite wonderful, so I thought I'd share this with you. The section is called Great Heart. As a Dhamma practice, we sustain and deepen the intent of kindness, irrespective of the various identities and shadow forms that arise in awareness. That's enough. We establish clear awareness and sustained kindness in the moment where impressions occur and where responses arise. It's not about conjuring up any great feeling of emotional warmth, but a process of staying in touch, of not blaming oneself or others, and not going into the past to rehash old issues. Thus, staying at that point of hurt, ill will, and pain, always bearing with what's there, then begins to carry the awareness across to compassion and transpersonal wisdom. Compassion is the kindly eye of the helplessness of our suffering. Compassion is the kindly eye on the helplessness of our suffering. Interesting phrase. On the helplessness of our suffering. We're going to suffer. No exceptions there either. When we experience this without blame or defense or struggle, compassion arises. As it arises, irrespective of the identity or the value of the wounded being, compassion sweeps over judgments of others and ourselves. It knows how terrible it is for anything, even a mass murderer, a tyrant, a poisonous snake, to be trapped in pain. When entering into this sphere of compassion, it is not a matter of doing anything, blaming or feeling sad about it, or wishing it were different. Instead, it's about entering that place where one touches the pain directly. Then, through staying in the hurt, where the mind can't do anything, has no remedies, ideas, or philosophies, it comes out of the position of me. The small localized state of mind opens out of the default self and other, into the great heart. The non-doing of such a heart has powerful effects. Instead of trying to conjure it up and feeling frustrated if it doesn't work or I'm not good enough, we let the healing happen by itself. Then there is a sense of grace, of receiving compassion that is greater and more boundless than any of one's personal attributes or efforts. Truly, this is called a divine or sublime abiding. And through contemplating the selfless nature of this abiding, the mind lets go, not only of ill will, but also of the push of becoming and self-view. This is the shore of the beyond. The shore of the beyond. I like that phrase too. It's like, this is where we start to shift into something more than our small self-view. So he's talking about compassion here. So what does this have to do with loving kindness? Basically, in the Theravada view, compassion arises when a heart full of loving kindness encounters suffering in the world. Compassion just will naturally arise. And whether that's suffering out there or suffering in here, that same compassion arises. We have compassion for ourselves. We have compassion for all others, for all beings. And when we experience that, then as he says, and through contemplating the selfless nature of this abiding, the mind lets go. It lets go of this of ill will, but it also lets go of this sense of a separate self, because we see that we're connected to everything. And we're connected to all beings. That's why the Buddha emphasizes that this has to be for all beings. If we start to exclude, then we're not, we're heading in the right direction, but we're not there yet. We have to sort of take it in and understand this feeling has to be for all beings without exception. And of course, I got a little bit of poetry just to finish here. I've been rereading my poetry books lately and coming across always, oh, I haven't read this one in a long time. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In, and the poem is called One. Within us lies the answers to our deepest questions and the antidote for all our fears. The divine is not an abstraction. It's as clear and intimate as a heartbeat or a whisper. We are penetrated, suffused, caressed, cell by cell and synapse by synapse, with the same love that set the galaxies to spinning. No matter how identified we become with mind and body, we can release the thoughts that blind us to the truth. Seek the still point where the words you and I lose meaning, where we meet and merge as one. It's a nice description of metta practice and metta feeling.